Jeffrey, let's talk about Iran, which I think, you know, across the political spectrum, there are voices saying that his bombing of these three sites in Iran is blatantly unconstitutional. Let's start with that. Mm-hmm. Got a lot more ground I want to cover, but let's start with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main point is that according to international law, a country cannot attack or bomb another country unless there is a UN Security Council resolution authorizing them, or if it is what's called a preemptive attack. This was neither. Neither was Israel's attack on Iran. So this was a war crime that was perpetuated by both Israel and the United States. And any country that doesn't meet those two criteria, you know, commit a war crime. So that should be the headlines around the world about Israel bombing and attacking Iran and the United States bombing and attacking Iran. And I just will say just briefly that preemptive attack is what the language that our media and the administration and the Israelis used. But this is false. Preemption in international law means your country has to be under imminent attack by another country, and you can go on the offensive if, for example, their planes are in the air in your airspace. This was actually, and this is why when the United States launches illegal wars, like, for example, against Iraq and against Iran, the Republicans and Democrats use the language of preemption, because according to international law, that is lawful, when they're really arguing what the Nazis argued at Nuremberg, which is preventive war, which is we had to attack Poland
before one day Poland might attack us.
So, but, and the Nazis didn't do very well at Nuremberg.
No, they did not. But beyond the UN, we have a U.S. Congress that has an authority to declare war. The declaration of war has to be with the U.S. Congress. I mean, there's some language, and I believe the Second Amendment, that provides the administration with some wiggle room, but not very compelling wiggle room. And it's nice to see at least some members of Congress and some in both parties saying, hey, we need to have this discussion before you take this kind of an action.
Yeah. More and more Democrats are discovering.
And some Republicans.
Yeah. And some Republicans are discovering Article 1 of the Constitution. I mean, it is the longest article. And Congress's ability to declare war is straightforward. This happened during the Obama administration when the Republicans in Congress were criticizing Obama for not bombing Syria after they crossed a red line. And what Obama did was actually quite clever. He said, under Article 1, it's your authority to declare war, so I would like you guys to start debating this tomorrow. And then the Republicans said, well, you know, let's talk about the Mets game. Or, you know, and part of that is that Congress doesn't want the responsibility for war a lot of time, because if it goes bad, they can blame the executive. In this case, a lot of Democrats, and I think you said maybe a couple of Republicans, are saying that it's time that the United States, you know, follow the Constitution and follow the Constitution.
And you would think there'd be more outcry from elected officials, since the polling, well, I mean, again, maybe the polling is no longer relevant, but between June 13th and 18th, YouGov, that entity polled 1,500 American voters. And the question was, do you think the U.S. military should get involved in the conflict between Israel and Iran? Only 16% of Americans said yes, with even most Republicans mm-hmm. saying no.
Yeah.
A Washington Post poll about the same time had a similar level of opposition. Now, that may have changed, but, you know, most Americans are saying, no, we don't need to be doing this.
Yeah. I mean, cable news, you know, tends to get excited about war. It tends to be about the only thing the United States does anymore anywhere in the world. But having said that, now that Iran is talking about closing the Straits of Hormuz, already gas prices have increased 15 to 25 cents a lot of places around the United States. And if one-fifth to maybe perhaps one-fourth of oil is choked off, Iran met with Russia. There's two countries, Saudi Arabia and Oman, of course, that have some control over the straits, but really at its narrowest point, it's 23 miles. So I don't think that it's likely that Iran would try to intercept ships, because they have almost no navy and they would lose decisively in that battle, but they can mine the harbors. There's a lot of other things that they can do. Already a number of oil tankers are making plans to try to avoid the
Straits of Hormuz. How do you avoid the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, like I said, Saudi Arabia and Oman with pipelines taking the oil directly to the Gulf of Oman are really the only two big oil exporting countries that can avoid it. Now, the danger for Iran is that a lot of that oil goes to China, and China is not keen on this. However, perhaps China in the short term can get oil from the Russian Federation. But the reality is this is the only card that Iran has to play. Yeah. I mean, given this is the only card they have to play, and it's really their last card.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of bluster coming out of Iran, as you would expect, just as there's a lot of, the bluster-in-chief, of course, remains Donald Trump. But, you know, let me ask you about this. There is just some division within his own administration. I mean, Tulsi Gabbard, who had, had said not that long ago that it was, first of all, she said that Iran was not developing a nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. And Trump called her out, said, no, she's wrong, which, and I really don't know. So the International Atomic Energy Agency report stated that Iran had accumulated, this is back in May, that they had accumulated roughly 120 kilograms of uranium that was enriched by 60%, and that was dangerously close to weapons-grade levels, which is, I guess, 90%. Yeah. So maybe Gabbard's wrong, but anyway, she's the one who has been the most vocal over the years, and even still, about avoiding regime change wars, and now not only has Trump authorized the bombing of three sites in Iran? He's talking about a regime change. He's directly contradicting what he himself has said leading up to the election, and certainly contradicting what Gabbard said throughout her political life.
Yeah. I mean, Israel has nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Israel has nuclear weapons. Those are four words that if I was to ever hear a Republican or Democratic public official say those four words, I don't know. I think I may faint. It's just not uttered. I tell the story sometimes of when President Obama became president, Helen Thomas asked him what countries in the Middle East have nuclear weapons. And I just watched there and watched Obama dance around the question. And so
did he ever say Israel?
No. Israel is not a party to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Iran is. And so Israel and the United States are some of the only countries in the world that have for years blocked UN resolutions to create a nuclear weapons-free Middle East.
Right.
Iran is in favor of that. Yeah. So Iran is not a threat to Israel. And so what this will do in the long run is it is going to precipitate Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon. Because if you were Iran, if anybody who can hear my voice was Iran, they would understand that countries with nuclear weapons like North Korea or Pakistan or India don't get attacked. Countries without nuclear weapons, Iraq, Libya, we can go down the line, they get attacked. So Iran has probably moved a lot of its nuclear materials. Yeah, good. Another one. Has moved a lot of its nuclear materials, I'm guessing, out of a lot of these major sites. And now in the future, when the IAEA is not there, even if there would be a change of government, it would be pragmatic of Iran to speed up its nuclear weapons program. But not just Iran. I mean, you can look at what does Saudi Arabia learn from this? What does Japan learn from this?
Yeah, so let me ask you, how did North Korea pull off becoming a nuclear power with all the restraints that the U.S. and to some extent some of the other nuclear powers want to put on countries that desire the nuclear capacity? Mm-hmm. How did North Korea get away with that?
I can't really say specifically because I don't have any expertise on that. But it sounds like the topic of a good book. But back to Israel. I mean, Israel has stated, well, not state, they're undeclared, but 90 nuclear warheads, and Israel has a powerful enough military that they can deliver those from land and air and sea, and so. What this aggression, this illegal aggression, does, at least from a lot of people's perspective, you know, people analyze nuclear proliferation, is it will probably speed up countries trying to get nuclear weapons as a deterrent, you know, from being attacked. Right. Because the examples are just so blatant out there.
There is a level of hypocrisy that's hard to miss. You've got one theocracy in the Middle East, Israel. And come on, Israel is a theocracy. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yeah, and Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia is a theocracy. Yeah, and Iran is
a theocratic republic, right?
They're a theocracy. Right. Let's call them what they are. And yeah. So, it's okay for one theocracy to have an elected
president and an elected parliament. I mean, they're a hybrid. And most of what the young people in Iran would like is to keep the republic and ditch the theocracy. And hopefully the people of Iran, if that's what they want, they will get that one day. But
don't you think Trump attacking these three sites is going to solidify support for the ruling party?
Perhaps. We don't really know. I'm also one of those people that didn't anticipate Syria's government collapsing so quickly either. So I really am not comfortable saying yes or no to that question.
But I mean, the October 7th, the horrendous attack by Hamas on killing 1,200 Israelis on October 7th of 2023, that helped solidify support for Netanyahu.
Yes? Sure.
And so I see the U.S. action in Iran being counterproductive.
Yeah.
It's going to help make that regime more powerful.
Well, but at the same time, Iran is no match militarily for Israel. They are no match militarily for the United States.
But that doesn't mean they can't
probably wreak a lot of havoc.
Not just there, they can probably wreak havoc in a lot of other places.
But relative to their ability to act in the way that they want to, militarily, they're not up to Israel and the United States. But I mean, really, Syria was Iran's only Arab ally for a long period of time. Now that's not the case. You know, now China did a rapprochement with Iran and Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states are in opposition, at least publicly, to what is happening. But the Gulf regimes are not nearly as animated as their populations are in their opposition to what's happening in Gaza and also what is happening in Iran.
So I want to bring this back to the U.S. Constitution and the role of Congress. I mean, throughout history, there have been both Democratic and Republican presidents who have tried to thwart Congress's role in declaring war. But right now this is a pretty blatant example of where Congress should have a voice. And we have people on both sides. I mean, we have Marjorie Taylor Greene saying, quote, "Every time America is on the verge of greatness, we get involved in another foreign war." We have AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, posting on X, quote, "The president's disastrous decision to bomb Iran without authorization is a grave violation of the Constitution and congressional war powers." And Thomas Massie, a Republican from Kentucky, working with Ro Khanna, to sponsor a resolution, you know, and Massey saying that what Trump has done is not constitutional.
Yeah.
Now, my concern is that you've got people like Chuck Schumer who also say, yeah, this needs to come before Congress and I'll vote for it. You know, it just seems like a lot of Democrats are going to roll over and support war. which seems to be what often happens, you know.
We'll see, but I don't really see that happening. I mean, we don't really know where this is going.
Which part don't you see happening?
I think there is more. I mean, I don't think this is like Iraq. I mean, I think there is more opposition in the opposition party, the Democratic Party, right now, to what is taking place. You just mentioned that there are some Republican members of Congress. I don't know if it's going to matter, because depending on how this goes, the executive may just act unilaterally, and you know, this won't be the only president who's acted unilaterally in foreign policy. But you know, we often forget though that the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was an international treaty where you're talking about 60%. Iran could only go to 4%. They were under 24/7, the strongest monitoring regime that any country has allowed for. And this administration just tore that up. All of this was unavoidable. And this is truly
unavoidable.
This was avoidable.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah. And this was truly this administration's war. I mean, the first administration, the Trump administration, said oftentimes we're going to end Iran as we know it. And, you know, to the Iranians, a country with nuclear weapons that says we're going to end you as you know it, that's pretty strong language.
Pretty threatening.
So really this administration owns this. The Obama administration had a solution that...
The nuclear deal.
With the whole world, that was a solution that took more than a year.
And Trump bailed on that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean...
And the mullahs in Iran said they would. They said, you can't trust the United States if you make a deal with them. And that pushed back the reformers in Iran because the mullahs ended up being correct.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Trump continues to talk about striking a deal with Iran. I mean, he says now, okay, we bombed these three sites. Now we want peace.
Yeah.
It's a funny position to put yourself in.
Well, I mean, I don't really think there's barely anybody in the world, with the exception of our sort of mainstream media, that takes what he says seriously. You know,
right.
I mean, at this particular point in time, there just isn't.
One more question for you. And, you know, we see things happening in this country that indicate a consolidation of federal power that Trump certainly... the sending of the National Guard, the federalizing of the National Guard in California in response to the protests against the ICE raids, the sending of, 700 U.S. Marines to California in conjunction with the National Guard. We see court rulings that the administration is ignoring. We see a lot of public pushback that the administration just doesn't seem to want to pay any attention to. Do you think this incident and what is to come out of it, I mean, we assume that this is not a one and done. We assume Iran's going to respond. Maybe Israel is going to continue to hit Iran and Iran fire back at Israel. And if Iran does respond to the U.S. militarily, there will be a response for sure. So this continued conflict, do you think this will lead to Trump finding more reasons to centralize his control, to consolidate power, to crack down on freedom and First Amendment rights in this country?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know. I mean, if there was another version of September 11 that was launched, it could be that martial law would there be an attempt to establish that or something like that. We don't really know. And I think in the long run, you know, when you have a Supreme Court that says that an executive has immunity from official acts, which I think would make the founders of this country roll over in their graves, then what official acts actually are will be something that Supreme Court and the highest courts are going to need to sort out. Because, I mean, in the federal district courts during his first term, Trump's attorney did say that a president has the power to go outside of the White House and shoot somebody dead and not be indicted as long as they were a sitting president. And that's a pretty bold argument.
Yeah. Hey, I got to run to a short break. Jeffrey Weiss with me here, folks.